Welcome back, Cavagansus Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Joe Heschmeyer's here. We said he was coming, and he's here. Joe Heschmeyer, very, very fine apologist and writer, and the author of that book we were mentioning just at the end of the last hour, Pope Peter, but many other books, including A Man Named Joseph, Guardian for Our Times. And did you see that, Joe?
Yeah, you
title
got it.
And subtitle, nailed it.
You know, people who are just tuning in probably don't realize what a feat that is, but those who've heard
people who are not familiar with my usual body of work, he got all the words right in a book title. This is a big day at Catholic Answers. And I hope you're well, Joe, there in Kansas City.
Yeah, I'm, not sick. I'm not in a fugue state or, recovering from delirium, so...
Yeah, I feel like you're saying that in a pointed way about one of us.
It makes at least one of us.
Yeah, one of us is not.
2 feet on the ground, yeah.
Yeah, I'm recovering, though. I think I'm doing a really good job, Joe. I'm going to just say I'm good enough and I'm smart enough and doggone it, people like me.
You knew I got that reference because I did a talk where I made that line.
Yeah.
That you were at.
Yeah, the Stuart Smalley. Yeah, classic Stuart Smalley. And it's Al Franken did that. And he was a U.S. senator and a very fine comedian. He was a U.S. senator and a very fine comedian.
It's I see where you're putting the adjectives.
He really is funny.
I was listening
though.
To a talk recently that mentioned the sheer number of comedians worldwide that have become politicians, including, of course, Ukraine's president as well. And someone in Iceland's government, I don't really understand. As far as I know, it's still Vikings. But they had like apparently a very funny Viking who was one of their leaders. So I don't know. It's just like not what you would expect to be a big feeder industry. So
no, right. Yeah, right into world leadership. You're working the club circuit and then exactly. Right into world leadership. But we do. There is a kind of in a way that reminds me a bit of the 1960s with rock stars. There's a bit of a turning to the comedian now as some kind of special figure, as some kind of somebody to hang your hat on.
I mean, there's some history of that. If you think about the history of court jesters, that yeah. It was the idea was that you could kind of speak the truth if you did it jokingly and kept it kind of light.
Yeah.
Also to take this in an even nerdier direction before we should probably go to the calls, the phenomenon of what's called mainstreaming, where controversial ideas are broached in media, is almost always the agenda is originally pushed through comedy.
Right.
So if you want to promote gay marriage, you don't start with like a drama of two homosexuals. You start with Will and Grace or Ellen. You do it with something funny and light and people don't really notice what they're kind of saying yes to. So I don't know. Right. I mean, the overlap between comedy and politics is bigger than one would think.
Cheech and Chong with the marijuana.
Yes, exactly.
Like that was a big part of their act. And I do think that it provides a kind of like, it's a counterpoint to the official line, which is, the films we like to make fun of now from the 1950s and 60s of the perils of marijuana. Well, they actually were right about a lot of stuff. But then you get Cheech and Chong. Well, that's a way of undermining all of that.
Yeah, well, and I think there's actually a spiritual point to be made here, which is that comedy can be very effective for satire, can be very effective as a way of kind of gently and delicately pointing out things that are too sensitive to talk about openly or too politically unsafe to talk about openly. Yeah. But it can also be a way of dismissing things with scorn.
Yes.
And, in apologetics, the one argument that none of us can answer is a scornful dismissal.
No,
the person who hears the case for God and just is like, ha, you idiots, why would you believe that? But doesn't want to actually know the answer to that question, just wants to laugh at you.
There is no answer to that.
Yeah, it's impossible to answer because it doesn't matter how airtight logically the case is. They are using humor as a shield against the intellect.
Yeah, I've noticed that there are, and I have preferences in that regard, that there are comedians who are very, very funny who are not scoffing at other people. Mm-hmm. And then there are people who their whole career, and for some reason, a lot of late night TV hosts, it's just scoffing and scoffing and scoffing. And the Psalms say, do not sit among the scoffers. And I feel like if you watch that, then that's what you're doing. You're sitting among these people who are denigrating other people. It's not the same as just being, goofy or even poignant, but in a way that's not attacking people.
Yeah, I mean, I was in college when Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert were at their kind of acme, And it was incredibly powerful. And it was sometimes the kind of good natured poking fun at the powerful, but it very quickly turned into a sort of scoffing dismissal of things that really would require thoughtful debate. So you take it an issue on which America was evenly divided, and they would just kind of make fun of the side they didn't agree with. And it's like, well, that's not a good way to treat 50% of your neighbors.
No.
To just assume they're too stupid to even engage with intellectually.
No, and I will go to the calls now, but Jesus was quite harsh about this.
Yes.
About, I think in Matthew's gospel, where is that where he says not to use the word raca? But
yeah, don't call your brother blockhead.
Yeah, don't
call that's my favorite translation of that word. It's just like, it seems like it should probably be something a little harsher than blockhead.
Yeah.
Because this isn't Charlie Brown. But I understand why they don't want to put like a cuss word in the Bible on the lips of Jesus.
Yeah, but he's quite, I mean, you know, yeah. He gets you all the way. He goes in three levels there of scoffing at other people. And among them is you end up in hell. I mean, one of the consequences is you end up in hell. So stop doing that.
It's a much more serious sin than I think people take it to be. I mean, people often don't think of it as sinful at all, but it really is. I say that as someone who has had to confess this more than once.
Yeah.
So,
but that's why, like, I can quote Stuart Smalley, because Al Franken, you know, he may have done, I don't know his full body of work, but that's just funny stuff. So the way, at least my recollection of Stuart Smalley is, it's kind of self-deprecating, silly humor. But we've got another Joe on the line for you. Joe in Boston. Joe in Boston, Massachusetts, watching on YouTube. You are next, Joe. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
All right. So, yeah, I have a female friend, a lapsed Catholic, who is now exploring various denominations. And I'm curious as to what you think the best argument is to assert that the Anglican communion practice is invalid, although I think they have some aspect of believing in parts of the real presence. And then she has apprehension about confessing sins to a male priest. And to be honest, I'm a bit sympathetic when I hear her points. And so why can't nuns hear confession?
Oh, great. That wasn't where I thought you were going to that question until you got to the very end of it. Let's answer it in two parts. So in terms of the Eucharistic theology for the Anglicans, it's really complicated because the Anglican Communion has switched its belief several times. So the original Articles of Faith commissioned under Henry VIII believed in transubstantiation and argued for it. But then after that, there were two successive series of Articles of Faith, and the most recent one, the 39 Articles, denounces transubstantiation as a superstitious fable. So that's the first big red flag, that one in the same denomination one day says, this is what we believe in, and the next day says, we reject this as false and superstitious and a fable. That doesn't look and sound like a church that knows what it's doing. It doesn't look and sound like a church, for that matter. And what you had were these careerist bishops who would just say one thing and then say the next thing to keep their heads quite literally. And so that's the background. What that means is, within Anglicanism, you get a wide variety of Eucharistic theologies, all of which virtually can point to something that's been said in the history of Anglicanism that would support that view. So that's the first issue. You will find, you know, so-called Anglo-Catholics who want to imagine that what they're doing is transubstantiation, want to imagine that they're still under the days of Henry VIII, that the Anglican Communion didn't decisively break with transubstantiation. But the problem from a Catholic perspective, and I think really just from an intellectually and logically coherent perspective, is they intentionally severed that communion. The changes under Edward to the ordinal for ordination they remove anything that makes it sound like the priest is one who offers sacrifice, which means that the priest is not a priest in any meaningful sense of that term. He's just a pastor with different vestments. So once you do that, you sever the whole idea of apostolic succession. You sever the actual power in ordination. So that's bringing us to the heart of this, which is going to answer both of your questions, both about the Eucharistic theology and about forgiveness of sins. These are in neither case things that Jesus gives to everyone, nor are they things that we give to ourselves. So when you look at, for instance, the institution of the priesthood, we trace it to the Last Supper, which is explicitly a meal held with the 12. Likewise, with the receiving of the Holy Spirit to forgive sins in John 20, this is while the 10 apostles are together in the room, and then Jesus comes to them. From there, it's transmitted through the laying on of hands, which is why St. Paul warns, I believe it is Timothy, do not be hasty in the laying on of hands, because a real spiritual gift is conveyed in that, which means that if you don't have that, you can't just decide one day you're going to forgive sins, you're going to celebrate the Mass, because you can't give that to yourself. That's the whole notion. Romans 10, St. Paul says, how can they preach unless they are sent? There's very much in the New Testament a top-down model that authority does not come from the people. Authority does not come from individuals choosing to send themselves. Authority comes from Jesus and usually through the church. Does that help, Joe?
Yeah, absolutely, it does. I guess, is this something you've encountered with other women who are considering their faith and considering the Catholic Church and going to confession and confessing to a male? And certainly some sins can be more sensitive than others, and having apprehension.
I think honestly, both men and women have trouble confessing certain sins to another person. That in addition to the difference between a male confessor, there's just a more fundamental issue that, and I would say all that's required is to confess number and kind. You don't have to get into the intimate details of the way that you fell. You can confess with enough specificity the priest knows what you're talking about without having to worry about getting into a tremendous level of detail. If you want something like spiritual counsel, you can go to a spiritual director, and those aren't just men. There are plenty of qualified female spiritual directors. If you want to just really pour out, here's the intimate nature of how I fell and why I fell, and can you give me counsel in the particulars? That's not really the time and place is not usually the confessional for that in the first place. The confessional is to confess your sins, not to really get into the diagnostics, except at a kind of broad level. But yeah, so I think that is a thing that people are sensitive about. The other thing I would throw out, I know this is kind of multidimensional, is the priesthood isn't like an occupation, you know, like being a doctor or a lawyer. That's naturally open to anyone, male or female, who desires to pursue it. The priesthood is like being a father. That's always how the church has understood it. That's how St. Paul talks about it, that you know, he's become their father through the gospel. That notion. And while there can be plenty of successful female doctors and lawyers and engineers and you name it, there aren't any successful female fathers because there are no female fathers. So that's kind of the idea. The reason this is tied to the male priesthood and the reason the priesthood is male is because it's actually expressing something relational about fatherhood that I think we've kind of lost today.
I'm going to leave it there, but I do have a suggestion for you. I just want to share this with you, Joe. Several years ago, there were some women who were posting on, you know, one of the things, Instagram or TikTok, I don't know what it was at the time, about bad experiences that they had in confession. And so we had a whole conversation about that with our chaplain at the time, Father Hugh Barber, one of the great priests I've ever known, and said, let's talk about confession. And it got very real. And this is one of the things Father Hugh is very good at, just very real brass tacks, how to avoid bad experiences in confession, how to make a confession, how to do what Joe was describing, which is basically, you know, number and kind of sins, so that you don't have to, there's a lot of things you don't have to say in confession that many people may think that they're obliged to share with the priest. And that was a Catholic Answers Focus episode, and it was called The Surprising Thing That Brings Jesus Joy. So if you look up Catholic Answers Focus, The Surprising Thing That Brings Jesus Joy, you'll find that whole special conversation we had with Father Hugh about women and confession, but also about just the avoiding any kind of creepiness in confession, because it's a private moment, and that can have that can be, as we all know, private intimate moments can be wonderful, can be the joy of life, or can be among the creepiest things that happen to us. So check that one out. We'll put it on the show notes for today's show, the link to it, or just search The Surprising Thing That Brings Jesus Joy with Father Hugh Barber on Catholic Answers Focus. We got to take a quick break, right back with more with Joe Heschmeyer, Catholic Answers Live.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
I'm Jeanette DeMello, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register and co-host of Register Radio with Matthew Bunsen. Join us every week as we talk with the Register's expert writers and editors about the news you need to know and offer authentic Catholic insights on the important stories that impact your life. Register Radio, every Saturday at 7 p.m. Eastern and Sunday at 11 a.m. Eastern here on EWTN Global Catholic Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Having a very, very fine Friday afternoon here. Maybe it's Friday evening or even Saturday morning where you are, wherever you're joining. Or maybe you're listening on the podcast later in time and space. Wherever it is, we're glad you're here with us. It means everything to us because we really like doing what we do. And up next is Mary in Oklahoma, who's watching on Twitch, which is kind of cool. I always like it when people connect with us using technologies that I have no idea where you would even find that. Like, I don't.
Someone's calling in from their smart refrigerator.
Yeah, right, that's going to happen. I'm calling you on my refrigerator, but I don't think that has happened yet. Mary, go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. So I was talking somewhat about the church's stance on abortion and how we don't support it regardless of the situation. And I need help in responding to a thing they said in response to that.
Okay.
So when I told them that we don't support abortion, no matter the situation, they said that it sounds a bit like forcing women to carry a pregnancy, whether they want to or not, sounds a bit sexist and misogynistic, especially considering that the church has a patriarchal authoritative body in the form of the Holy See. So I was wondering how I could respond to that.
Great. Well, I think there's really two angles that I would approach it. The first is the whole framing of forced birth is false. Like, it's just a fictitious frame. And here's what I mean by that. In no other context that I can think of, would you call someone forcing you to do something, legally prohibiting you from killing someone else? There are all sorts of ways in which, you know, those around you might get in the way. And it might be an inconvenience to you in big ways or in small ways for them to exist. But we don't talk about that being forced by the government or the like. But second, imagine a world in which abortion doesn't exist. Maybe it's before abortion methods have been invented. Maybe it's a state or a county in which no one wants to perform abortions. Who is forcing a woman to give birth in those situations? Because to say forced birth in this way suggests that there's a right to get someone else to perform an abortion for a woman upon request. I mean, and where is that right coming from? And what is that right? It's kind of a convoluted and incoherent sort of idea. There are all sorts of things that the government doesn't give me the right to do, but that doesn't mean they're forcing me to do the opposite. If a woman is forced to give birth, in quotation marks, it's by nature, it's by biology, it's not by the government. What she's being prohibited from doing is killing her child. What I mean is that telling you not to do X is not the same as forcing you to do Y. And I can think of no other cases in which we would use that kind of misleading language. But the second thing, and I know that might be a little, you have to kind of work with someone about how they're viewing the issue. When it comes to men and women and them being treated differently, I would say this. If a man consents to have sex, he is accepting fatherhood. If he says, no, I don't want to be a father, and I don't think she's going to get pregnant, and then she does, she can then sue him for child support, and rightly, because in engaging in this action freely, he consented to that. And so it's reasonable to view women as much adults as we view men, that if you consent to have sex, and you're consenting to motherhood, you're consenting to fatherhood, you're consenting to parenthood. Now, of course, this leaves the category of rape, and those are the hardest cases to kind of talk about. But in any case, this is not about punishing women or about, you know, there's nothing of that. We think it's wrong to kill an unborn child. We think it's wrong to end the life of a human being at any stage of development. This means it's wrong to end the life of the child in the womb of the mother, but also outside of the womb of the mother, either in the case of a child that's been born, but even in the case of like frozen embryos that have been fertilized. Those are living human beings at a very early stage of development. To intentionally destroy them is doing the same thing. So whether or not the child is in the womb of the mother, the reason this falls disproportionately on women is because only women can carry children, not because the church is, you know, wanting to punish women in any way. The truth is, like, what the church is calling us to is to treat others with dignity and compassion. That's not a sexist message at all if it's being treated in kind of a just and fair way, not given the kind of misleading frame of forced birth and patriarchy and the like. Mary, does that make sense, Mary?
Yes, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mary. I appreciate that. I appreciate that call. Folks on Facebook are advocating that we take the following question. I always like that when they do, because this woman's from Australia and it's difficult for her to call. And so they're like, Sai, why don't you take this question? So Marion's question from Australia, Joe. G'day. A question for... No, I'm not going to do that. All right.
Really sorry.
Marion from Facebook in Australia. Hi, a question for Joe. I teach a catechism class at a local public school. See, this is not America. I was inviting them to our parish confirmation program, even though most never go to church. One question I couldn't answer. How did Peter know what Jesus meant by church in Matthew 16? Was the term used before then?
Yes. So the term, the Greek word there, ekklesia, means assembly. And this is the word that was used to translate a Hebrew word, kahel. And kahel means, you know, it means assembly, it means gathering, it means literally like those who are called out or those who are summoned. So you've got a summoning together of the people, and that organization, that assembly, that congregation is called the kahel in Hebrew, and this is translated into ecclesia, and that also means called out. So, I don't know, hopefully that helps.
I was going to go back to Marion and ask her, but I forgot. I read her question. I hope that helps, too. Somebody told me on Facebook.
That very convincing Australian accent was actually you.
Good day, Joe. Someone told me on Facebook, and I don't know. I never know. Are you supposed to believe Facebook or not? I don't know. I believe the people. I don't know if I believe but Facebook. But it says that a public school is what we would call a private school in the United States.
Oh, yeah, this is a very confusing. I don't understand the public school, private school thing. The UK does this as well. Yeah. And I will just acknowledge to those listening, we don't know what that means. Also, yeah. When you say you're in like sixth form, no, that just sounds like you're a caterpillar who's become a butterfly.
And none of us has ever seen a lorry. Okay, we've never seen a lorry. We don't know what that is. Stop saying lorry. We speak English so much better than you.
In defense, I will say, yeah. We make fools of ourselves by saying, put a shrimp on the Barbie, and they call them prawn there.
Oh, there's a little twist ending to that one. Yes, we... do you know, Joe, when I was in Australia, some young people... young toughs at a school there asked me to speak in an Australian accent. So I tried to do it, and they thought it was hilarious. And I said, fine, then you speak in an American accent. And you know what? This is their American accent. I loved it. Dude, let's go surfing, dude. That was their American accent. I was like, yes.
I was in San Diego, and I think I met that person.
Yeah, you have met that person in San Diego, but that's like all across America. Nobody's going, dude. Let's go surfing, dude. And they hit the R really hard.
As a representative from the middle states, I'll just say, it's very funny when we're watching a show and set in like Spokane, and you're just like, wow, I didn't know they had that many palm trees. So there's a very small geographic slice of the country that is linguistically and otherwise very overrepresented.
Right.
And
but we're the closest to Australia, I guess. Hawaii's closer, but they probably, there's a lot of Californians in Hawaii going, dude. Let's go surfing, dude. That was it. That was their whole American accent. I was like, have you never seen an American movie? Like, what's with you? All right, let's go to Spokane, Washington, as a matter of fact. Mo in Spokane, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Thanks for waiting, Mo. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Oh, okay. Thank you so much. I have a family gathering coming up, and my family is ultra liberal, And my husband and I reverted to our Catholic faith about 5 years ago, and so we kind of caught them all off guard. And now it's like they won't make eye contact, and they're worried we're going to say something. But I would love to find a way to share my the creeps, and I'm wondering what, like, have you ever been in this situation? What can I do?
All right, you're going to have to wait, though, because the music's playing. So we'll get, excuse me, I beg your pardon, COVID. It's back. All right, I'll take a quick break. Joe Heschmeyer's here. I'm going to work on my Australian accent. Mo, you're going to have to wait, but we will get an answer to your question right after this. Catholic Answers Live.
Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you. Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Matt Swaim here. Monday on the Sunrise Morning Show, we'll celebrate the Feast of St. James the Greater and take a look at this week in Catholic history with Kevin Schmiesing. Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest, having fun on a Friday afternoon. Glad you're here with us. Mo in Spokane, we made her wait because she wanted to talk about talking with family members who are practically atheists and maybe don't want to talk about the faith. Well, first of all, let me check in with Mo. Is that did I basically get the idea there?
Yes.
Okay. So, Joe, some tips on talking with practically atheist family members.
Yeah, let me give a tip on what not to do and then three tips that probably won't work but have a better chance at working than a lot of the other ones. So that's my kind of caveat. Like, you know, bear in mind, I guess I should say this at the outset. There are plenty of people who walked away from Jesus Christ. So don't imagine that if you just, like, perfect your technique that you're going to have a 100% success rate, because our Lord and God didn't have a 100% success rate, and it was not because of anything he was doing wrong. People are still free to say no to the message, and they do frequently. But with that said, the thing I would discourage is anything that looks like moralizing or scolding or kind of being bossy or preachy about it, because that doesn't usually work with anything. If, you know, someone says, hey, I don't think you should drink Diet Coke, you're doing terrible stuff to your body, that's not going to make me not drink Diet Coke. But if someone asks me questions that are more engaging, maybe we'll have a different conversation. But the point is that when you unsolicited offer any kind of life advice, even when your intentions are really good, that overwhelmingly turns people away. So that's what I would say. Don't do that. Don't answer questions they're not asking in kind of aggressive way to get them where you already are. That I don't know anyone whose conversion story started that way. I'm sorry. Say again.
That's my normal approach, so I appreciate it.
Perfect.
All right, Mo.
So
good.
Let me give you a few alternative approaches that might work a little better. The first is ask the big questions. That recognize that everybody, including your relatives, is seeking for truth, goodness, and beauty. And we can't help but do that because it's how we're made. Now, we sometimes numb ourselves to that with work or more often with entertainment or just kind of mindless diversions. But when we have those actual moments to ourselves, when we can actually think about things and desire things and the like, we find in our hearts this hunger for truth, goodness, and beauty. So helping the other person to see that, and you can do that literally just by asking them, what are you really excited about? What are you really passionate about? Those kind of things can help to awaken that eternal longing that can only be satisfied through Jesus Christ. Second, share your story, which is to say, if you say, yeah, I had that same, you know, longing, I had that same fill in the blank, and this is what God did in my life. It was really amazing. It was really transformative. And you don't have to say, you should do it too. That part, you can leave it implicit. That works better for a lot of reasons in modern society. Like, we put a large premium on your truth and your story and all this, and while we're very skeptical of the notion of objective truth. But if they can hear what God has done for you, and you tell it in a very personal way where you're not being preachy about it, that can still be very attractive. Third, Blaise Pascal, writes in the Penn States, when we wish to correct with advantage and to show another that he errs, we must notice from what side he views the matter. For on that side, it is usually true. And admit that truth to him, but reveal to him the side on which it is false. In other words, if your family members, if they're really activists about a certain cause, if they're really invested in X, Y, or Z, figure out what's the true, good, beautiful thing that they're actually chasing after there, and acknowledge that and praise it. So you'll notice that there's a twofold shift. First, you're not leading with what you think they're doing wrong or need to do differently. And second, you're not leading by telling them, like, I've got it all figured out, you need to come on to my side. Rather, you start with asking about them and what they're interested in, and then finding and praising the good that's already there, or the good that they're looking for and realize they're not finding, depending on, you know, their story, their circumstances. And that can give you a little more of an opportunity, depending on their personality, their openness, and the like, that can give you a little more of an opportunity to plant a seed to say, yeah, let's build off of that, you know, your hunger for social justice or your hunger for whatever it is. That's good, and we can do even better. That sort of thing, where you're no longer us versus them with them, but you're together seeking the truth. Does that help? Does that make sense? Because I know the tendency to that you just, you know, name for yourself. I do the same thing, to become very kind of combative or didactic. And it just
like
doesn't
no
work usually.
Saying anything, and here's some facts for you. Something like that.
Yeah.
So I really appreciate that. That does help. And especially pointing out that people did walk away from Jesus too, because I'm always like, I'm terrible at this.
Oh, yeah.
No. Right. St. Paul in 1 Corinthians talks about how, like, one plants and another waters. And, you know, I've seen this enough. I've been doing stuff with evangelization and apologetics long enough to know that the big kind of wins where I've been, like, really at the finish line with somebody, it's almost never with anybody I actually planted the original seeds with. Somebody else did all the work, and I was there in the last leg of the race. But that gives me a lot of hope that maybe there are other people who I've planted seeds for that I don't get to see it because somebody else is, you know, reaping what I've sown in this way. So take some solace in that. Like, God is the one who does all of this. You do your part, and your part may not be to see them from A to Z, or A to Z, as our Australian friends would say.
Wrongly.
Wrongly.
Mo, it's been a very pleasant call. I'm going to give her the choice, Joe.
Thank you so much.
You know what I'm talking about, Joe? I'm going to give her the
choice. I do.
Mo, I want to give you a free book.
I'm so excited.
Yeah, but you get to choose. We got a book about Jesus, and we got a book about Peter. Which would you like, the book about Peter or the book about Jesus?
Gotta Go Jesus.
Oh, that is the first time in the history of this show.
All right, give her both. Give her both of the books because she gave the right answer. Send it. You know what books? Don't even look at me like you don't know what book. Mo, thank you. You make, because I wrote the book about Jesus, and Joe wrote the book about Peter, and everyone always wants Joe's book. And now you made my day.
Yeah, if it sounded for a split second to listeners like Si was glorifying our Lord.
Wait, Mo. What?
Sorry, what'd you say?
My husband listened to your show on his commute during the year that I was going through RCIA, and it brought him back to the Catholic Church after being away for like 30 years. So,
oh, Mo, that, praise God. Man, you that now you really did make our day. God bless you.
What's your husband's name?
His name is Rohan.
All right. Well, hopefully people can offer up a little prayer of gratitude for his journey so far and that it continues to go well.
I'm sorry. Yeah. I can't help myself. Do people call you Mo and Ro? Like, does that happen?
Well, yes.
Okay. I just needed to know. I'm sorry. It's none of my business, but all right.
Well, and I was like, and I'm talking to Joe. Totally weird.
Oh, that's right. Joe. All right. Well, we got to go. Now you know. All right. Hang on for your books, though. You're getting 2 free books. I like talking with Mo.
I thought you were going to go with like a Lord of the Rings reference there with Rohan.
Oh, yeah, the Riders of Rohan. No, I'm still not 100% back, Joe. I'm still not 100% back. It's nice to know that you are confident that I'm going to say something dumb, though. Like, you don't know what it is, but you're pretty sure I'm going to do it.
I was going to quietly support you.
Francis in New York City. New York City! Listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. We're glad you're here. Francis, go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hi, thank you for taking my call today. Just a pretty basic question that came up in discussion this week. Would it be considered a sin or wrong to, if a person's in financial hard times, which is probably popular right now, to gamble by scratch off lottery tickets, all those Mega Millions and what have you? Is it considered wrong to do so or a sin?
Okay.
So it's a nuanced case, and you're totally honing in on the relevant details, like the financial struggle. So paragraph 24:13 of the Catechism says games of chance, and it gives the example of card games and the like, or wagers are not themselves contrary to justice. But then it says they become morally unacceptable when they deprive someone of what is necessary to provide for his needs and those of others. So the first thing it warns you against is don't gamble with the money that you need. If you have like a certain amount of money you're going to use on entertainment and your choice is like go to a restaurant or go to a movie or go to the casino, and you're going to have the most fun going to the casino, and you're just blowing money you were going to blow anyway on something and it just for an enjoyable evening, that's fine. Then you don't need to feel bad about that at all. But on the other hand, if you really can't part with that money, then it's wrong to use the stuff you need and give it away on a game. It would be wrong, likewise, to go and buy like a new TV for yourself if you can't feed yourself and your family. So that would be an act of injustice to those you're taking care of. So that's where the moral issue really comes in. Years and years ago, someone told me the gambler's prayer, which just goes, "Dear Lord, please help me break even. I really need the money." And if you're praying that, don't be gambling. Like, you can't part with the money. Don't part with the money. Like, assume that whatever money you're gambling with is gone. It's no longer yours. And so that's the first thing to watch out for. The second thing the Catechism warns against is like gambling addiction. And then it also warns against cheating and unfair wagers. But I don't think any of those things are kind of the heart of your question.
Well, basically, it came into people that are having financial hardships, and I mean, you can say a novena, St. Jude, or what have you, but it's also genie in the bottle type feel, because it's more novelty. And then, if you do have your faith in Christ, He'll provide for you, and this is just a lesson to be learned, and He'll be there for you at all times.
Yeah, so I think you're right. Like, one of the temptations, if money is very tight, it's very tempting to say, well, I can't really make ends meet as it is. I might as well put a lot of money on gambling because worst case scenario, I just continue not to make ends meet. And if everything goes well and the horse comes in or whatever, now I'm rolling in the money. So it really is the problem with a lot of the way gambling is set up. And I think scratch off tickets are guilty of this as well, is that they end up being kind of a tax on the poor or a tax on the mathematically illiterate, because they're preying upon people who are in desperate situations, who are looking at desperate remedies. And that's not just true of gambling. You know, get-rich-quick schemes work the same way. Investment opportunities that are really sketchy work the same way. Frankly, a lot of the way, like, cryptocurrency and Bitcoin was being promoted was working the same way. You were taking people who were very financially strapped, who were desperate and wanting to get rich, and playing upon that to take the last few dollars they had.
Francis, I'm going to leave it there because we got to take the break. But thank you very much. That's actually a very important question that we don't get enough, and we haven't probably talked enough about it, because gambling is growing. It's kind of insidious the way it's growing. It's just more and more available to more and more people, including minors. So I think let's make a note of this, Joe and Darren, that maybe an hour on gambling at some time in the future would be a well-spent hour on the air. Francis, thanks. I got to take this break. Be right back with more Joe Heschmeyer, Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
We have a big problem. Our culture is dying, and souls are in danger of being lost. The answer is conversion to Jesus Christ in His church. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a Catholic organization, and we have hundreds of teams spreading the good news throughout the country. But we need your help. The harvest is great, but the laborers are few. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
By providing quality programming faithful to the teachings of the Catholic Church, EWTN is television that viewers can trust. Whether it's films, documentaries, news coverage, lively discussion shows, or kids programs, we highlight the truth that is the eternal word. For a complete schedule of EWTN television programs, visit EWTN.com and click TV. EWTN, the Global Catholic Network.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Joe Heschmeyer, our guest, and several folks on the line. So I'm going to try to just keep going back to the phones, let people ask their questions, because we don't have all that much time left. Let's go to Carl in Ohio, listening on Ave Maria Radio. Carl, go ahead with your question for Joe.
Ah, Joe, dude. I understand there's been a lot of people claiming that Christ taught some strange things. And I'm wondering if you agree, what do you think are the strangest things that he taught?
Yeah, I feel like you've got to get a free copy of Sy's book if you don't have it already.
Well, yeah, you know that's coming.
Yeah, well done if that was... So, actually, I kind of want to know, Sy, well, how would you answer that question? I'll answer after you take a stab at this.
Well, as a matter of fact...
You did write the book.
I did write the book. And so, and remember the day that the book came out, you hosted the show and I was the guest. Do you remember that,
Joe?
That's
right. I forgot about that.
And somebody actually asked that. And to me, it's very, very easy. The strangest thing Jesus teaches is that we eat his body and drink his blood, or we don't have life in us. There's nothing stranger that he ever said than that. That is as a matter of fact, I think it might be the strangest thing, because it's true, that anyone ever said. That's the strangest reality of this life. But I use the word strange to mean that it doesn't fit in any materialistic view of the world. It doesn't fit in with any category that a materialist would. So strange means it's otherworldly. It's out. It's not part of the natural world, so to speak. And so that's the strangest thing. No one's ever said anything stranger than that. And if they have, it's less strange because it's not true.
Yeah, I think that's a great answer. I was going to take a slightly different one, but along those same lines. But I think it's probably important to begin with the problem of anthropomorphic aliens in sci-fi, which is to say, if you go watch like old science fiction, one of the major problems is that like the aliens all look like man-shaped because they're all like people dressed up as aliens.
Right.
But you have to assume other planets with different climate and gravity and everything else are probably not going to end up with creatures that look like 6 feet tall and human-shaped with, like, two arms and two legs and the like. And I mention this to say that there's a certain limitation to the human imagination, naturally. And so when you hear the doctrine of the Trinity, I would go so far as to say no one has ever posited a view anywhere close to that of God, that there are three persons in one divine essence, indivisible in some way that we can only kind of speak into and can't totally comprehend or grasp. That sounds like something that was not of human origins, because I don't see how even the most skilled human writers are getting to that. It's too weird. It's too strange. It would be like, you know, carefully describing the surface of Mars when you've never even, when you don't even know planets exist. You know, like it's too much out of this world. Yeah. To really describe. So that's the first one I would point out, the nature of the Trinity. Likewise, the idea that God becomes man is so shocking and so weird that what it means for Christ to be totally human and totally divine, I don't think we sit with that enough and realize how strange it is. I think if you accept how weird the Trinity is and how weird the incarnation is, then the Eucharist is also super weird, but it fits in. It's weird in a way where you're kind of like, oh, yeah, this seems to be written by the same guy. Like, this seems to have the same author because it's weird in the same way.
Carl, what do you think?
Ah, I think those are pretty good. And I'm waiting to see what else is in your book.
Oh, this was
what a
well...
What would you say, Carl? Out of curiosity.
Oh, you mean what I think is strangest?
I
think maybe the Eucharist. I think that's that's out there.
Yeah.
Good answer.
I'm with Carl. All right, Carl, you get the free book. Here it comes. Hey, but you got to give us your address, all right? And then
okay.
And then call back with your review, unless you don't like it, and then don't ever call again. All right, thanks, Carl. Hang on. The book's coming to you. Let's try to get as many on as we can, Joe, all right? Well,
because
I'm just realizing the clock is ticking away up there on the wall. Let's
all
go.
Right. Lightning round. I'll try to go fast.
Let's go to Jay in Pennsylvania listening to EWTN on Channel 130 Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Jay, we're glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Yeah, I really enjoy your program. Thanks for taking my question. It's kind of a big one, but I'll just... say, what would you say is kind of the fundamental similarities between Protestants and Catholics in terms of their concept of salvation? And do you think we're close enough that we can, you know, share that view? And I'll leave it at that.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a great question. Benedict XVI puts it like this. So Martin Luther famously describes justification as being by faith alone. And different Protestant denominations, different Protestants have very different understandings of the way salvation works and the relationship of good works to the whole process of salvation and sanctification and the like. But I think Benedict puts it very well. He says Luther's phrase, faith alone, is true if it is not opposed to faith and charity and love. Faith is looking at Christ and trusting oneself to Christ, being united to Christ, conformed to Christ, to his life. And the form, the life of Christ, is love. So, in other words, if by faith alone someone means merely believing and not living in that trust, then we have a major difference. If they mean trusting in Jesus, by faith alone, they mean trusting in Jesus, not trusting in yourself, but trusting that he who can do all things can strengthen you to do whatever his will is, then we're saying what seems to be the same or something very similar in different words. We just want to make sure that we preserve this idea that faith, in as much as it's belief, in as much as it's intellectual assent, that by itself isn't enough if you don't then act on your beliefs, if you don't then act on that kind of trust. It doesn't mean anything to say that you trust that the bridge will hold you if you're afraid to cross it still. You have to then move in that faith. The just man lives by faith. That living by faith involves action. So that's what we mean. We don't mean like you need to go work your way to heaven. Does that help? Does that make sense? I know there's like a whole umbrella of different Protestant views.
Yeah, no, that's perfect. Because I think my experience has been, you know, having both Protestant and Catholic friends and colleagues that there's so much that is similar And I think this is quite true, and I appreciate your explanation.
Okay. I'd like to send you a book as well, if you would like to hang on. Our own Jimmy Akin wrote a book called The Drama of Salvation, where he talks about, he gives a very full kind of expression of the Catholic view of salvation, but with an eye towards what Protestants also believe. So it's a very full and helpful guide to the Catholic view of salvation. If you'd like it, The Drama of Salvation, just hang on. And we'll send it to you. If it sounds like I'm going quick, it's because I'm trying to get to everybody before we have to go and down to Texas. Donnie in Texas, also listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Donnie, glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
All right, thank you. I'll be real quick. So today's the feast day of St. Mary Magdalene, and I was just kind of contemplating on that, and I thought, from the meditation today that she went to anoint Christ early in the morning. But I was thinking, why would Mary Magdalene go alone by herself to anoint Christ with a sealed tomb that would be difficult to roll back?
We actually get an answer to that really directly in Mark 16. So we know that full-grown men can move the stone. Mary doesn't go by herself. She goes with at least two other women, Mary, the mother of James, and Salome. And in Mark 16, verse 3, they're asking each other, who will roll away the stone for us from the door of the tomb? So they're also saying, we haven't totally thought this plan through. We don't know what we're going to do about the stone. And when they get there, it turns out the stone is already removed because the angel removed it. So, yeah, that's a great question that they seem to have thought about on the way to the tomb.
Okay.
That makes sense.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, that's one of those. That's one of those
absolutely.
Ones. I think where sometimes people will say the Gospels contradict one another, but this is one of those examples of a false contradiction. I think, Joe, wouldn't you say that people say, well, Mary only went by herself in what is John's Gospel, and then
John it says John 20 that Mary Magdalene came to the tomb early, but. And then she goes and sees, and then she runs to their disciples. But then she says, and this is literally the next verse, they have taken the Lord out of the tomb, and we do not know where they have laid him. So even though John only mentions Mary in verse 1, Mary mentions we in verse 2. So we know she wasn't by herself. John just doesn't give us a full list of who was there.
Yeah. Thanks very much for the call. But I always find that one instructive because these are short documents, the Gospels. There's a process of selection, and the Gospel writer mentions what he thinks is important.
If you say your friend was at the party, you're not saying they're the only one who was at the party.
Right, yeah.
You can't say because they didn't mention X detail, they're denying X detail. That doesn't follow.
Right. And Jimmy does a great job of kind of resolving a lot of these. He's got something on his website, jimmyakin.com, where he's got one on the infancy narratives, where people will say, well, the infancy narratives contradict one another, and he resolves all those issues. And then the resurrection narratives, he's got one on the resurrection narratives, but people say they contradict one another. But many of these contradictions are not contradictions, they're just differences.
Right. If you were to give like three different accounts of the American Revolution, even that don't disagree with each other, they're still going to include different details. They might mention different founding fathers and the like. So too, I think we find the same thing all over the place, that oftentimes the gospel writer will just name the person who is the source of information, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So if there were like three or four people there and one of them is the one you heard it from, you'll just say, well, this person was there or they said this, when it was really more of a conversation. And you're not giving a legal transcription. You're just reporting what has been reported by eyewitnesses.
Thanks to everybody who called. We got through everybody, except we had one more caller to get to, and that caller left just before we were about to take that call. That's why I had this little chat with Joe here at the end. But it's always nice to chat with Joe. Joe, thanks for a really good hour. I had a really good time, despite the fact that you are
unrelentingly mean to me. I had a really good time, too. Sorry, I made fun of you being sick.
Yeah, exactly. You're really a bad person, Joe Eschmeyer. And you come from such a nice family, and you have such a nice family, and... Do they tell you this?
They pity me, which is that's my play.
I'm glad they pity you. That seems like the appropriate response to Joe Heschmeyer. Joe, we'll see you next time. Let's do that show on gambling one of these days. Thanks.
Oh, bet on it.
All right. Thanks for being with us. That wraps it up for us. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.